يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis, a packed one as normal and big news as well. So I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. Harry's also a lawyer and political commentator as well. Harry, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, James. Indeed, very, very important days.
Indeed. And, you know, you can't avoid the situation in Libya. And Colonel Gaddafi, not gone, but certainly on the way out.
Well, Colonel Gaddafi is on the way out, and astonishingly more quickly than we would have thought possible. A few days ago, nobody, the NATO, the West, the Arab Leagues, even the Libyans themselves, did not think that they would be able to advance as quickly as they did. But they have advanced. They have control of most, but certainly not all, of Tripoli, the capital. And the most symbolic A fall was the fall of Colonel Gaddafi's headquarters, and it is compared to the Bastille of Libya. So in a sense, all the symbols of the old regime are crumbling. However, the fears and the threats are still there today.
Now, I presume we're not going to get a Saddam Hussein-style hiding in a rabbit hole got him type of triumphalism from the West. But Colonel Gaddafi, via an audio broadcast that's been broadcast on local TV, has said, has he not, triumph or martyrdom about the end game for him?
I think Colonel Gaddafi is a different kind of person than Saddam Hussein. Gaddafi, unlike what many people might think, is an extremely intelligent person, quite crafty, very well experienced, a very good chess player, and he actually would probably think that he would rather go in a big explosion in by dying rather than being caught, arrested, and sent either to The Hague, to the ICC, or tried locally, which now seems to be the more likely option. So I don't think it's going to be an Iraqi-style situation in many ways, not least in terms of the leader himself.
Now, we don't know how the National Transitional Council will govern, and it's one heck of a challenge, isn't it? I know they've started bringing their senior people into Tripoli in anticipation of this moment. Mm-hmm. I know you don't like me asking you the what will happen next question, but if you were in that position, what are the sensible ways of pursuing sort of sensible governance?
Well, the first thing I would say, James, is let us be clear, let us hope, let us pray that the National Transitional Council, which is a national council, but it is also a transitional council, which means it's ephemeral. It's not something that is supposed to stay there. Mm. And Abdul Jalil, the head of the National Transitional Council, has actually said that once there is an established government, he would resign. So in that sense, the National Transitional Council is a temporary setup, makeup, that would lead toward a post-Gaddafi situation. But the National Transition Council is not an all-powerful body. Libya is rife with tribal, ideological, religious conflicts, and therefore it is not going to be easy to manage those. Let us not forget that it's a huge country and there are too many conflicting interests, and therefore running the country, taking the country is one thing, running it is an entirely another thing. Now, let us assume that they managed to impose control over the country and that the two areas which are witnessing most of the fighting now, Sirte, which is where Colonel Gaddafi's Qadhafa tribe is based and who are still loyal to him, and Sabha in the south of Libya. Those are the two critical points at the moment in terms of fighting that's going on. Let us assume that some sort of order, law and order, will prevail in the country. What needs to be done is to distinguish it from the Iraqi situation. In other words, first of all, we don't go dismantling every single security apparatus and the police force and everything and lead to a state of lawlessness that would actually make Libya into another Iraq in terms of banditry, thuggery, bloodbaths, attacks, etc. But in order to do that, therefore, the first thing in terms of state building, I believe, would be to have security. Security is the most important thing. And I think security is something that the NTC has already started, the National Transition Council has already started applying across the country. But I think it will really become possible once Gaddafi is captured, because he represents that symbolism that of the, an old regime still lurking in the corridors between him and his son or heir apparent, Saif al-Islam. They're still hidden somewhere, presumably still in Libya. So security, security, security. But following that also, the Libyans themselves should start addressing the idea of institution building. And interestingly enough, some while ago I saw on a wall in Benghazi a slogan in Arabic which said, "Give us institutions," which is exactly what is necessary. This was a country run by one man, and therefore institutions were the man. The country was the man. Everything was the man. So what now is needed very, very seriously is to build those institutions once security is there. And it has to be done by local Libyans. They have to build their own future. They have to find a way to do it, certainly with Western assistance, certainly with Western training. At the end of the day, there have been conferences and meetings in Qatar, in the USA, etc., pre the capture or the fall of Tripoli, where a transitional roadmap has already been drawn up as to how we move forward. However, all this assistance, whether on the ground or off the ground, has to eventually be in the hands of the local Libyans. And let us not forget that there are two ways also of giving them a push. One is immediate in terms of unfreezing some of the assets, either in the States or elsewhere. $1.5 billion are already being unfrozen, but they are asking for an initial sum of $2.5 billion. And the other thing is that let us say that Libyans are fortunate to have oil. Fortunate and not so fortunate, because it, as you well could imagine, the struggle becomes even more acute. But oil until now has basically been 90% of its income and of its budget. So once the oil starts flowing out again, once the refineries start working again, which in my estimation would need anything between 12 to 18 months, then Libya would begin standing up again. But state building is it. Security is the first platform.
Will that be the time where France, the UK and the US come a-knocking and saying, "Oh, you remember when we helped you out?" Is that when our interests come into play?
You know, that's a cynical way of asking the question, James, and I can see the grin on your face across the studio. All this machinery that I don't know what you call it. But anyway, what you say is absolutely true. One thing we have to realize is that there's no such thing as a free meal. Those who thought that the French and the British, aided by NATO, went in only for the sake of preserving or safeguarding the human rights of the Libyan people, or to prevent a massacre that could have very easily happened in Benghazi if there had been no intervention. Hence, I understand the reason behind it, which was made legitimate by the endorsement of the United Nations Security Council. However, there is no such thing as a free meal. And at the end of the day, the time will come when the West and those who have helped most, particularly the French, but also the British, the Americans, the Qataris and others, will sort of say, "Well, it's time now to repay us for all we did for you." And that is what nationhood is all about. Lord Palmerston said that famous thing that there is states are interests, and therefore that is what we should look at, and that is what we should expect. But that is another step coming after the capture, or the killing for that matter, of Gaddafi. There's a $1.7 million ransom on his head for anybody who kills him or arrests him, and security having been imposed on the country, which to me is crucial so that we don't have an Iraqification of the situation in Libya.
Now, there are plenty of points for prayer. The people of the entire country, no matter religious or not, of course. But my mind again turns to the Christians of Libya, because you and I spoke on the last Middle East analysis about Syria and how Christians, you know, with the Ba'athist regime, had a degree of freedom and certainly didn't feel so badgered. Do we have a similar situation here? Would the Christians have thought, "Well, you know, Gaddafi leaves us alone pretty much"? Or will they be thinking, "Oh, crikey, what on earth is our plight going to be under a new regime?"
You know, it's interesting, James, because I think whilst that is very, very true in Syria, and there are all sorts of ructions within the Christian communities of Syria, which in themselves are quite a heterodox community, that what would happen with Bashar al-Assad versus what would happen without Bashar al-Assad. In Libya, the same thing is not there. Religion is not really the issue. The Christians are not that important or that prominent a factor in Libya, although there are Christians. We have spoken, you and I, as you just said, about the churches in Benghazi and Tripoli, about having our own Catholic Archbishop in Tripoli as well. So in a sense, the Christians are important, but a large number of them are expatriate Christians. Many of them will have already left. And I don't think the Christian aspect of this conflict is so prominent, as is the fact that there are fears that there are Salafist radical Muslims who have already infiltrated into the country. And so when I talked about the National Transition Council facing many challenges, some of them being tribal, others being political, others also being ideological, I also included with that the religious and the kind of threat that this hardcore Salafist uncompromising religious attitude would evoke in Libya in the future.
Harry, I've noticed that the rebels, as they were called pretty much across the board, are starting to be called revolutionaries.
Mm-hmm.
What's the distinction?
Well, that's interesting because there's so many different conversations. If you go to Al Jazeera, they call them the revolutionaries. If you go to the BBC or some other outlets, they call them still the Libyan rebels. In my opinion, James, and it is a personal opinion, but I think it's based on sociology as well, I would classify at the moment that the MENA region is in the grip of six major events. The three that have already taken place in terms of their first initial phase are Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya, with the overthrow of their leaders. Then there are the three others, namely Syria, where we are having continuing bloodbaths, even though we are very busy with Libya these days, as well as Yemen and Bahrain. So I would qualify Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya as revolutions because we have already overstepped the first stage, which is the removal of the leader. Whereas in Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain, they are only popular revolts or uprisings of some sort. And it's interesting that in Arabic, I can hear on many channels, Arabiya, Jazeera, etc., the word intifada or yantafid, which was initially a word that was attributed to the Palestinian uprising, both the first and second ones in the Holy Land in Palestine. However, it is also being used because it has not yet reached the state of a revolution. So whilst I'm very careful how to describe the Libyan freedom fighters, rebels, revolutionaries, but I think at the moment the word thuar or revolutionary would apply to the Libyan case.
Now, you and I have talked off mic a little bit about some of the prominent slogans sung and spoken of the revolution, as we might call it at this particular stage. Tell us a bit more about the story behind that.
Well, slogans are very important, James, because they empower people, they motivate people, they instill people with the sense of reassurance. So there are two kinds of slogans, if I may use that term. One is religious slogans, and the other one is more popular ones. Now, in my opinion, the epitome of those slogans is happening in Syria. If you look at what is happening every evening after the Ramadan prayers, when people come out of their mosques and demonstrate in different cities and towns like Homs, Hama, Deir ez-Zor, Daraa, whatever, they constantly sing slogans, chant slogans about the overthrow of the regime. We don't want the regime is against us because the regime is afraid. Those are slogans that have become very popular in Syria. Then there are also the religious ones based on the Holy Quran and the Islamic faith. Now, in Libya, interestingly enough, one of the most prominent ones that has actually come up recently is from a song, a quotation from a song by Kulthum. Now, I don't know if you know Kulthum. I've known Kulthum since I was a wee toddler in diapers. She is an Egyptian diva. In fact, she is the diva par excellence of the Arab world. Some even say that she had three vocal cords, which made her voice not only melodious, but really captivating and enrapturing. And in one of her songs, she says, "I am the people. the people of honor and struggle. أنا الشعب شعب الشرف والنضال. And this is one of the slogans that is being repeated across Libya today. So in some sense, you have the popular folkloric input, you have the religious input, put those two together and you have the makings of what is happening on the ground.
Can almost hear it now. Now, we're fast running out of time, Harry, but just turning our attention to the wider MENA region. Obviously, it's all Libya at the minute, but just give us a quick overview of where we stand with the other countries.
I think we should keep an eye on Syria. We should also keep an eye on Yemen, whose president is still in Saudi Arabia, but is threatening every day or promising every day, depending to whom you speak, to return to Yemen. But I think what is important is to look at Syria and see what happens there. And interestingly enough, James, I saw a few caricatures today on one of the satellite channels, which showed Gaddafi and Colonel Gaddafi and President Bashar al-Assad shaking hands, and which reminds of a common history of oppressing the people. The other one was one of President Assad holding one of those masks of Colonel Gaddafi's face, which was found at the bastion, which the revolutionaries captured yesterday. And he was looking at it and said, "Poor Colonel Gaddafi, look what happened to Muammar." And in a sense, there is now the hope amongst the activists, the demonstrators, the human rights observers in Syria, and those who are supporting the uprising and the revolts in Syria, that Libya would be another example, another incentive, another encouragement for the Syrians to move forward with their demands, because it is quite clear at the moment that we in the West neither have the resources nor the legal legitimacy to actually go in there and bomb Syria the way we've done with Libya. However, as President Sarkozy said only yesterday, there will be other ways of trying to impose more pressure on the regime to try and stop the violence and the bloodshed it is causing. And as you know, that could be done through the United Nations Security Council, barring the veto of Russia. It could be done through the Human Rights Commission. It could be done through very many punitive other measures. In a nutshell, I think, James, I would just say that we are witnessing now the very slow beginnings of possibly a redrawing of the map of the region. Now, these are big words. They're bold words for somebody who always claims he's not a prophet and knows he's not one, too. But if you look a little bit at what is happening, in my own political imagination, I can already see some of the pieces on the chessboard. Talking about Gaddafi's fondness for chess, the chess pieces moving around on the board. And I think that we could actually eventually witness a change in the whole makeup and demographic dynamics of the region. What we should not forget, that this is not going to happen overnight. So the Arab Spring is not a one-season revolt or revolution. It is a multi-season one that would hopefully lead to an awakening of the Arab world in order to defend its citizenship rights, not in order to substitute one dictatorship with another form of dictatorship.
Dr. Harry Hagopian painting audio pictures for us there in the redrawing, potentially, of the Middle East. Thank you very much, Harry, for your insight there.
My pleasure,
very
James.
Very good, as always. And join us again for another Middle East analysis.